In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Dear Jesus, may I enter into the eternal divine order of God to place my absolute nothingness in the heart of the Most Holy Trinity, to give to my God the joy of fulfilling the purpose of my existence by doing all the acts of my life through the Immaculate Heart of my Mother Mary and in the divine will of God. And in this same manner, may I live, pray, act, eat, walk, sleep, and do everything. May my soul be devoid of any other longings, wants, or desires, and may you, my beloved divine will, do with me whatever you want or desire. All I ask is that you bind me to your most holy will so intimately that I may never swerve from carrying out what I know to be your good pleasure, and that I remain so docile to the movements of your divine will that you never perceive even a breath of resistance in my soul to your requests of me. Come, divine will, with all the angels and saints, especially my sweet Mother Mary, to touch my forehead, to imprint on it the Holy Spirit and infuse in me true light, so that I may understand the truths and the good that are in these writings and prayers. Amen. So I want to begin with June the 20th, 1925. And Jesus talks to us about how we can have heaven on earth in this passage. Louisa said, I felt immersed in the holy will of God, and my sweet Jesus, drawing me to himself, clasped me in his arms very tightly and said, my daughter, how beautiful is the rest that the divine will has in a soul when that will is there as life, as distinct from just simply doing the divine will. And a soul who lets my will act and love entirely and completely. This is all relevant to our fiat. It's very wonderful. The Lord's just given it to us at the right moment. Okay. So he wants to rest in us, but he needs to be there as the Lord. He needs to be there as the dominant one. He needs to be able to act with love, divine love within us. So he needs us given to him entirely and completely. Now notice, there isn't a bit left for us. It's entirely and completely handed over. You must know, he said, as the soul breathes, palpitates, operates, and everything else that takes place in her, since my will is in her as the center of her life. This is the operative thing. He's looking for this that we will hand over completely to him, because that's when he's free to do what he needs to do in order to reign on the earth. So since my will is in her as the center of her life, it is my will that breathes in her. It's my will that palpitates. It's my will that gives motion to her work. It's my will that's in the circulation of her blood and everything else. Since this will is the same as that which is in the Most Holy Trinity, the three divine persons, it happens that they feel within themselves the breath of that soul. Isn't that incredible? They feel her heartbeat and they feel her motion. That's why you're going to hear in a moment when Louisa has a little flip in doubting that he says that all of heaven was shook. Because the same divine will that's operating in heaven is operating in the soul. Also, he said, every time our will decides to do an act, it makes new joys, new beatitudes, new happiness come out of us, which harmonizing everything among the divine persons, they form immense seas of new happiness. Now notice, everything is new. God is a creator. He will not patch up something. Do you remember Jesus said that Christianity was not a patch on Judaism? Okay, he won't patch something up. He'll make something completely new. And that's what he wants to do with us as well. Make something completely new and beautiful for God. And as he's able to operate in us, he wants to produce new beatitudes. Now, a new beatitude is something that hasn't been there before. And therefore, all of heaven benefits from this. All of earth benefits from this. All of purgatory benefits from this. The three kingdoms. So as every time our will decides to do an act, it makes new joy, new beatitudes, new happiness come out of us. And they harmonize with the three divine persons naturally because it's the one will. And they form immense seeds. Everything to do with God is immense because he's eternal. He's infinite. Immense seas of new happiness, which enveloping all the blessed in heaven, cause them to remain enraptured within these joys. Isn't that utterly amazing that if we allow the Lord to operate the way he wants in us, that we can be the cause of the saints in heaven having new happiness and new joy? And this causes them to remain enraptured in these joys and to be shaken by this rapture when our will wants to form more acts of the will in order to delight us and to make us issue more beatitudes. They are just so totally captured by this extraordinary, immense, endless movement of new life, new beatitudes, new joy, new everything. But he wants to do that for us as well. Now, because of this, the soul on earth, understood, who lets our will live within herself, reaches such a point that as she lets the divine will operate, now notice as she lets, that's the continuous surrender and abandonment to the divine will, which is moment by moment and day by day. As she allows the divine will to operate, she gives us, the most blessed Trinity, the occasion to put our beatitudes and the harmonies and the infinite joys of our love into motion. So here is this little nothing on earth, allowing the divine will to operate in her. And he's saying that that gives him the opportunity to do all of this wonder for all the saints in heaven. Of course, the souls in purgatory benefit as well, and everybody on earth. It gives us the occasion to put out our beatitudes and harmonies and infinite joys. She makes us issue new beauties of ours. It's no wonder he wants us to surrender. Our will operating in the creature is so very pleasing, tender, and lovable to us. It gives us new surprises, because the creature still has free will and can decide, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do the other. So we can even give surprises to God. It's amazing. It gives us new surprises. It puts our things in motion to give us the return of our glory, our love, and our happiness. And all this by means of the creature who has given the place within herself to allow the divine will to live. Now, there's the operative bit. And if you have your own book, that's the bit you underline. You colour it. And it all happens because the creature gives a place within herself to allow the divine will to live. So he said, how could you not love this birth from our will? The birth from the divine will is the soul surrendered and allowing the divine will to work. More so, since our will renders this creature more lovable, more gracious, and more beautiful to us in such a way that in no one else do we see her prerogatives. Naturally, it's not in anybody else, because if the others have not surrendered and abandoned themselves to the divine will, then the divine will can't operate that way. She is a work done by our will. That's Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art created in Christ Jesus. She is a work done by our will with such mastery as to enchant the whole of heaven. Now, when you go back to the book of Genesis, chapter 2, you have this wonderful description of the extraordinary amount of attention that God gave to making the first man. In fact, it's described as if God was making a statue. And only when he breathed life into that statue did it become a living being. Now, this is going to be important as we go on in the messages tonight. So this person is a work of art that God has done an enormous amount of work within it. And you see in the volumes that we have studied in Louisa that the Lord continues to work within her. And sometimes she says, what are you doing? And he says, well, I'm housekeeping or I'm doing something. But he's always working within her, and he needs to expand our soul so that we can take more of the divine will. She is a work done by our will with such mastery as to enchant the whole of heaven and to render her lovable to all, that's all the saints and all the angels and all the souls in purgatory. And even more so to the Most Holy Trinity. It's fascinating. And while he was saying this, Louisa said, he clasped me more tightly and letting me place my mouth in his heart. Now, it has to mean on his heart or towards the, it's probably the wound in his side that she's actually talking about. Jesus said, you too drink our Beatitudes in large gulps. Satiate yourself and as you want and take as much as you want. Now, I want to give you Psalm 36, verses 8 to 9. Lord, they feast on the abundance of your house and you give them to drink from the river of delights because you are the fountain of life. I also want to give you Isaiah chapter 12, verses 1 to 6. And it ends this way. Drink deep from the wells of salvation. That's why it's most likely the open wound in the heart of Jesus that she's asked to put her lips to. Let's come to June the 25th, 1925. And this is a very important message for understanding Jesus's words and actions and what he wants from us as well. This is very important for the consecration in August. Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, my adorable Jesus, all love and tenderness came to my poor soul. First, he placed himself near me and he fixed his gaze on me as if he wanted to tell me lots of things. But instead of that, he actually wanted to expand my intelligence. This is terribly important for us because as we study the writings of Louisa, I'm sure you've come up against stuff that you didn't really grasp. Not because you couldn't understand the words on the book, but because your relationship with God hadn't come to that place where that could enter in. So it's actually important to actually say to the Lord, please expand my intelligence. Give me understanding. Expand my soul. And if you're hesitating about the consecration at all, a prayer that the Lord gave to me many years ago when I was surrendering to him, I said, tell me what to say to you. I do that all the time. I say, Lord, you give me the words. You put the thoughts into my head. You put the words into my mouth. And what he said was, say these words, Lord, take me from myself and give me to thee. That's a wonderful thing. It just absolutely says everything. Take me from myself and give me to thee. And so here Louisa finds that he's expanding her intelligence. Now this is 17 volumes into the most extraordinary experience that a human being could have. And he's still expanding her intelligence because if he's to give her more, the intelligence must be expanded. And he has made it very clear that as you grow, as you continue to study in these volumes, if the growth doesn't actually go along with your study, then it'll become quite obtuse to you. But he wanted to expand my intelligence because it was incapable of receiving and understanding. Now, receiving and understanding are two different things. You could hear the words that I'm saying. You understand the English language. You know what I'm saying in words. But to understand that in the depths of your being is another matter altogether. You've got to be in a particular place in your relationship with God for that. And then Jesus laid himself over my whole person and he hid me under himself. He covered my face with his, my hands and my feet with his. It seemed to me that he was all attentive on covering me and hiding him under. So everything is through him, with him and in him. He is our divine ladder. It's him. I want to give you Psalm 32, verse 7. You are my hiding place, O Lord. I want to give you Psalm 57, 1. Hide me under the shadow of your wings. I want to give you Matthew 23, verse 37, where Jesus said, I want to put you under my wings like a hen puts her chicks under the wings. He always gives her a very graphic experience so that she goes from this very graphic experience to try and tell us what this means on a spiritual level. So she said she felt very happy, hidden and covered by Jesus. And then she goes on and she tells us that she forgets all about her sufferings and forgets all about the privations and everything else. And it's like as if, oh, heaven is back. This is fantastic. So let's move down the page a little bit. So after he kept me all covered and hidden within himself for some time, to the point where I thought he'd never leave me again, because that's the issue all the time with Louisa, I heard him call the angels and the saints to come and see what he was doing with me, and to come and see the way that he covered me up with his entire person. And then afterwards, he shared his pains with me. Now, in volume 17, this is quite unusual. It was the normal thing in the earlier volumes. And then he moved her away from that into a higher plane. And it seems strange that he comes back to give her more pains. But watch what he's going to say. As long as we are on earth, we cannot avoid pain and suffering. We just cannot do it. And he's going to tell her that the Lord uses trials and difficulties that we experience in relationships and in ourselves and in circumstances. He uses everything, the pain and suffering of our lives, to bring us deeper and to bring us much further in the relationship with him. So here's Louisa with the extraordinary relationship that she has, and she's still experiencing this. So she said, afterwards he shared his pains with me and I let him do everything. You see, she's abandoned to him. And even though I felt as though being crushed by those pains, I felt happy. And I experienced the joys which the divine will contains when the soul abandons herself to it, even in suffering. Now, you really need to take that sentence and really look at it. First of all, she said that the sufferings were so great that she actually felt crushed. And then she balances it up completely by saying, but I also experienced the joy of being abandoned in the divine will. The joy of being abandoned in the divine will balances out the pain. So I want to give you Hebrews 12:2, where the author tells us that for the joy that was set before him, Jesus endured the cross, despising the shame. Joy and suffering together. What makes suffering unbearable is that when we don't have the inner joy of union with God, and therefore we don't have that abandonment to God, and the suffering seems to be useless and having no meaning. But in this surrendered state, everything is full of meaning and full of grace. This is very important. So now he goes on to tell us that if we're going to abandon ourselves to him and to pronounce a fiat for him, the thing we need most is understanding. We need to grasp the enormity of the grace that he's giving to us. And then he says himself, the actual surrender is not difficult. But if you don't understand it, the surrender is difficult. So this is a very important section. And then after Jesus made me suffer, he told me, my daughter, my will wants to give itself to you more and more. As long as we're on the earth, the Lord wants us to reach a fullness. If your journey is finished, he'll take you home. If he hasn't taken you home, your journey's not finished. And if your journey's not finished, there is more to experience. There is more to suffer. There is more to grow. And there is more honour and glory that we are to give to God. And so every moment of every day is extremely special. So the divine will, he said, wants to give itself to you more and more. But in order to give itself more, it wants to make itself understood more. Now, we've already used that example some time ago. Jesus himself gave it a few volumes back, of a person holding a jewel in their hands and they have no idea of its value. And therefore, you don't just throw it there. It's just something, you know. And then they go and they have it valued. And the first person that values it says, €1,000. Oh, so now this thing is worth €1,000. So I'm not going to throw it around the place. You go to somebody else, and he's an expert in this area, and he says, €1,000, that's worth €1,000,000 or €2,000,000. And then all of a sudden you discover, wow, I didn't know I was a millionaire. It's a bit like that with us in the divine will, and that's why Jesus used that example. So here Jesus is saying, if I'm to give you more of my divine will, you have to understand it, because if you don't understand it, you are not going to value it. And if you don't value it, you won't use it properly. So you have to understand more. And in order to render what the divine will manifests to you more stable, in other words, you're not going to be losing it, and safer and more estimable. Now, estimable means worthy of admiration and respect. In other words, I'm now respecting this gem that I have discovered is worth a couple of million. The divine will, in order to achieve that, gives you new pains. Okay, the sufferings and the trials give us understanding. The sufferings and the trials also give us wisdom. Now, anybody who has been through a time of great suffering and trial knows, and if you endure it for the love of God, then you'll find that you'll come out of it a much wiser person than you were before. So the sufferings and the trials are therefore very important. And we might have the idea that, you know, once you surrender to the divine will, everything's going to be love, joy and peace after that. Not when you're on the earth, because you have to grow. There's a whole journey and there's a whole mission to accomplish. So the divine will gives you new pains so as to dispose you more. Watch this now. And to prepare in you the empty space. Now, we have this extraordinary ability to say, oh, no, I'm surrendered to the Lord. I've given my fiat. You know, I gave it to him a few years ago. But there's still a little bit of yourself there. And so he scours out more and more space for himself by using these cleaning methods that he has called trials and sufferings. And so he needs to get us to the place where the self is gone, self-will is gone, everything is gone, so we're ready for the new creation. So he wants empty space. Now, St. Thérèse of Lisieux said that in different words. She said that you must go to God with empty hands every single day if you want him to fill your hands with treasures. Okay, so watch that empty space bit. And if you are sincere about abandoning yourself to the Lord, then he will give you an opportunity to let go and let go and let go so that there is, in fact, enough space for him to come. I think I told you before that Elizabeth Wang, whose wonderful spiritual paintings can be found on radiantlight.org, she painted a picture of a soul just having received Holy Communion. And she painted the soul like a container. And she had the Lord sitting on the edge of the container, looking in a little puzzled. Now, he had just been received in Holy Communion. And the container, which was the soul, which should have been empty to receive him, to receive the fullness, instead of that, it was full of all kinds of boxes, tall and small and fat and thin, not necessarily sinned. But the junk of every stuff that we like to collect and clutter and all the rest of it in our inside of ourselves, and the memories of the past that we just won't let go, and blah, blah, blah. And so the Lord looks in and there's actually no space for him. And so while the person has received Holy Communion, they receive very little benefit. That's very sad. So what he's saying to us in the divine will is, do your spring cleaning, empty out all those corners where you've filled up with all kinds of stuff, and give me the space and I'll come. Because the divine will wants the noble cortege of pain in order to be sure that the soul, be sure about the soul, and to be able to trust her. Isn't that absolutely incredible? But if we provide him with the empty space, he knows he can do it, because we've got rid of the thing in us, the self, that will oppose him. It's always pain and crosses, he said, that open the doors to new manifestations of God. Haven't we all got testimony and multiple testimonies of that? It's always pain and crosses that opens the doors to more secret lessons and to the greatest gifts in which I want to place in you. So he has to allow the trials and the crosses and the sufferings in order for those doors to open. In fact, if the soul bears my suffering and sorrowful will, she will become capable of receiving my delighting will. Now, we've watched that in Louisa. In the early volumes, she takes all this suffering and then she knows the ecstasy of the divine will taking over in her. In fact, if the soul bears the suffering and sorrowful will, she will become capable of receiving my delighting will and will acquire the hearing in order to understand new lessons. Now, notice that's interior hearing. That's not external stuff. She will acquire the hearing. Pain will make her acquire the celestial language in such a way that she will be able to repeat the new lessons that she has learned. So, if we don't allow the Lord to put us through this school of the wilderness, is what I call it, then we're not going to reach the promised land of the divine will. So in the next paragraph, oh dear, he's going to ask for complete sacrifice. On hearing this, Louisa said to him, "My Jesus and my life," she said, "it seems to me that it takes complete sacrifice in order to do your will and to live in it. At first sight, it seems nothing." It's very interesting when you come to read these writings first. Not all that difficult until you try and put the will out. But then in the practice, it's difficult, because not my will, but thine be done all the time in absolutely everything. Not having a single breath of one's own will, even in holy things, in good itself, seems to me to be too painful for human nature. There's Louisa in touch with reality. Therefore, will souls ever be able to come to live in the divine will with complete sacrifice? That's the korban. Hand it over. And Jesus said, "My daughter, everything lies in understanding the great good that comes to her by doing my will." Everything is in the understanding. If I understand that this gem actually has a value of 2 or 3 million, as distinct from me throwing it there, thinking it had no value at all, that changes everything. He said, everything is in understanding the great good that comes to her by doing my will. What in understanding what this will is, which wants the sacrifice, and everything is in understanding how this will does not adapt itself to mixing and living with a low, small and finite will. The infinite, perfect and eternal will of God cannot mix with my low, small and finite will, which is messes things up. It can't happen. So you either have one or the other. So he's saying, really, it's all or nothing. The divine will wants to render the acts of the soul who wants to live in my will, he wants to render them eternal. He wants to render those acts infinite, and he wants to make them divine. That's why we've got to get rid of the junk. And how can the divine will do this if the soul wants to put the breath of her human will, even in a holy thing? I'm not sure what Louisa means by holy things, whether she means going to Mass or prayers or whatever. Because it is actually possible. I've taught spirituality for years, and it is actually possible for a person to be indulging in their own self in prayer when prayer is easy for them. They're enjoying prayer, they're having peace in prayer. So they spend hours in prayer. So if the Lord gives them any aridity in prayer, then no, they're not going to do it. Because what they were doing was actually giving in to themselves. They weren't really praying. A person who's really praying will pray even hanging out of a cliff. They'll pray at the bottom of the sea. A person who really needs contact with God is totally different. And so even in a holy thing, it's really very important, because the human will can be very dominant in everything. I gave you the example of working in a parish in another country, and I went to the church early in the morning, which is my habit when I'm staying in a parish. And with the church all empty, I absolutely love it. I just say, Lord, this is great. It's just thee and me. It's wonderful. And we were getting on with sort of just being together when a person came in. This was all right. I wouldn't have a problem. The church is big. It can hold a couple of hundred. But that person who came in was a woman who walked straight up to me, literally dug her elbow into me and said, get out. That's my place. She did not genuflect. She did not recognize the presence of God. She sinned against her neighbour. And she was in a house of God, and she had come early for Mass, obviously to say her prayers. I think that's what Jesus is talking about, that even in holy things, you can sin. That was a terrible shock for me. So naturally enough, I got up and put a big space between me and her. Since the divine will and the very faulty, sinful human will cannot mix, one of them has to go. Okay. How can the divine will do this if she wants to put the breath of her human will even in a holy thing? Because the human will is always finite, and you can't mix finite with infinite. And then the living in my will, he said, would no longer be reality. It would only be words. Now that would be one of the temptations that people could have, is that they would say divine will prayers, that they would do the exercises, but they would not hand over their will to God, that they would not abandon themselves to God, and therefore it's all still external. Because if I don't hand over my will to God, the divine will cannot come and live in me. He says that himself very clearly. What would you say, he said, if a little lamp or a match or a spark of fire wanted to enter the sun, if you wouldn't mind, and to make its own way and to form its field of light and action in the centre of the sun? It's laughable. If the sun had reason, it would become indignant, and its light and heat would annihilate the little lamp, the match and the spark, and you'd be the first one to mock them. You'd condemn their boldness in wanting to form their own field of action within the light of the sun. I mean, the sheer ridiculousness of that is self-evident. And he said, such is the breath of the human will within mine. We don't realise that it is an insult to the divine majesty to think that my will can take over from his. Even in good things, your good things, there's your prayer and you're going to Mass and all the rest of it, okay? Therefore, he said, be attentive that in nothing may your will have life. Nothing. I want to give you Galatians 2:20. I no longer live, Christ lives in me. I'm surrendered, I've handed myself over. And so he said to Louisa, I covered you and hid you completely within myself, that you may have no eye but to look at my will alone, that you would give the divine will free field of action in your soul. Rather, the difficulty will be in understanding the living of the divine will, not in sacrificing yourself. Because if I want a car very, very badly, I'll go to all the lengths I need to go to find the finance and get that car. If you're a woman and you really have your eyes set on a particular outfit, you'll get it. And he's saying that if only we understood the enormity of the privilege of having the divine will reigning in us, that we'd pay any price and the surrendering of ourselves would be nothing. He said, the problem will be in understanding the living of the divine will, not in sacrificing yourself. I find that fascinating. In fact, once they've understood the great good that comes to them, that from being poor, they now become rich, from being slaves to their vile passions, they become free and dominating. From being servants, they become masters. From being unhappy, they become happy, even amid the pains of this poor life. And all the goods which are in my divine will, the total sacrifice of everything would be an honour. There you have the answer now. given by himself. The total sacrifice of everything would be an honour for them. It would be desired, it would be wanted, it would be longed for. And this is why I push you so much to manifest what regards my will, because everything will be in understanding it, knowing it, and loving it. Now, if you're going to join me on the 15th of August, which I certainly hope you do, eat these words, digest them. And so Louisa said, "My Jesus, if you so much love and want that this will of yours be known, that it may have its field of divine action within souls," she says, "why don't you yourself manifest the truths to souls, the great good which your will contains, and the great good which," she said, "your direct word would have a magic force, a powerful magnet, and you would have this creative power in your word. Oh, how difficult it is not to surrender to the sweet enchantment of your divine word. So if things are said directly by you, all will surrender." Now, Louisa is actually speaking quite logically, because we would all feel that way. But Jesus said, "Sorry, that's not the way we work. My daughter," he said, "it is my usual way that in the order of my eternal wisdom, to manifest my greatest works in one soul first." He did it in Our Blessed Mother for redemption, and he's doing it in Louisa for the fiat of sanctification. "It's my usual way to centralize in her all the good that my work contains, to deal with her one-on-one as if nobody else existed. And when I've done everything in such a way as to be able to say that I have accomplished the work completely within her," that's Philippians 1:6, "the Lord will complete the work he has begun in you. And I do it so much so that there will be nothing lacking to her. It's only then that I let it flow as though from a vast sea for the good of everybody else. I did the same with my celestial mother. First I dealt with her as if nobody else for the work of the redemption. No other creature even knew anything that was going on. She disposed herself to all sacrifices and to all the necessary preparations in order to make me descend from heaven to earth. I did everything as if she was the only redeemed one," which of course she was, because she had been redeemed from the very instant of her being. "But after she delivered me to the light in such a way that all could see me and take the goods of redemption, I gave myself to everybody, provided that they wanted to receive me." And of course, it's the same with the divine will, provided people actually want God to reign in them. So the big question we have to ask ourselves is, do I really want God to reign in me? He said, "It's the same will happen with my will. Once I've completed everything within you in such a way that my will triumph in you, and then like water, the divine will flow for the good of everybody. But it was necessary to form the first soul, and then all the others will come afterwards." It's exactly the same in the book of Genesis, chapter 2, verse 7, where he created Adam. And then afterward, once he gave this enormous amount of attention to this first statue. I'm using that language because you're going to hear it. And then afterwards, let the whole of humanity develop. So let's come to June the 29th, 1925. This is where Louisa has her doubt, and she gets a very strong reaction from the Lord. So she says at the beginning, "I was feeling oppressed," and so on. And she said, "A thought wanted to disturb the serenity of my mind. And if you found yourself at the point of death and doubts and fears came to you about the way you conducted yourself during your life to the point of making you doubt about your salvation, what would you do?" Now, somebody living in the divine will, okay? "But as I was thinking about this, Jesus gave me no time to reflect any further or to answer my thought. Moving in my interior, he made himself seen, shaking his head. And as though saddened by my thought, he said, 'My daughter, what are you saying?'" In other words, "Don't you understand all the stuff I've been saying to you about the divine will? This massive revelation that he's been giving." Now, if she's having difficulties with it, then I have mercy on you and me. "To even think about this," he said, "is an affront to my will. Neither fears nor doubts nor any danger at all can enter into the divine will. These are things which do not belong to the divine will. When you have the divine will reigning in you, heaven has come to earth. What is there to doubt or worry about? Rather, these are the miserable rags of the human will. Again, the human will wanting to interfere, wanting to intervene. My will is like a placid sea. And I've told you for a number of years that one of the signs of how well you're doing in the divine will is that the peace that passes all understanding is deepening within you. My will is like a placid sea that murmurs peace, happiness, safety, and certainty. And the waves it releases from its bosom are waves of joys and contentments without end. He said, in seeing you think about this, he said, I was shaken. My will is not capable of fears, doubts, and danger. And the soul who lives in the divine will becomes estranged from the miserable rags of the human will. Underline that in a whole lot of colours. The soul who lives in my will becomes estranged from all that misery and awfulness that you had before. And besides, what could my will fear? Who can ever raise doubts about the divine will's operating? If before the sanctity of the divine will, everything trembles and everything is forced to lower their heads, adoring the divine will. Even more, he said, I want to tell you something very consoling for you. Now, he's explaining why doubts and difficulties that about the divine will had just got to go. This is wonderful what he says to her. I want to tell you something very consoling for you and of great glory to me. It will happen with you and your dying in time as it happened for me in my dying. Wow. In life, he said, I operated, I prayed, I preached, I instituted sacraments, I suffered unheard of pains and even death itself. But I can say that my humanity saw almost nothing. I mean, it seemed as if the fruits, you know, were hardly there compared to the great good that the divine will had done. Nor did the very sacraments have life as long as I remained on the earth. But as soon as I died, my death put a seal on all my works, all my words, all my pains, and the sacraments. And the fruit of my death, I want to give you Matthew 7:20, by their fruits you will know them. And the fruit of my death confirmed everything I did and made my works, my pains, my words, my sacraments, which I instituted, as well as the continuation of their life until the end of the world, made them all rise again. So, my death put my works into motion and made them rise again to perennial or everlasting life. All this was right. In fact, since my humanity contained the eternal word and a divine will, which has no beginning and no end, and which is not subject to dying, nothing was to perish of everything that it did. Not even a single word. But everything was to have continuation until the end of centuries. So you look at Jesus dying on the cross and people looking externally at that thought, they were looking at total failure, how wrong they were. And will continue until the end of centuries in order to pass into heaven to beatify the blessed eternally. The same will happen to you. That is the incredible thing, he tells Louisa. My will, and we're not even halfway through these writings. My will, he said, which lives in you, speaks to you, and makes you operate and suffer, will let nothing perish, not even a single word, of the many truths that I've manifested to you about my will. It will put everything in motion. It will make everything rise again. Your death will be the confirmation of everything I've told you. And since in the living of my will, everything that the soul does, suffers, prays, and says contains an act of the divine will, all this will not be subject to dying, but will remain in the world like many lives. Notice remain in the world. working away, all in the act of giving life to others. Therefore, your death will tear the veils that cover all the truths that I've spoken to you, and they will rise again like many suns, such as to dispel all the doubts and difficulties with which they seemed to be covered in life. Now, during Louise's lifetime, the priests who were guiding her and helping her, they were quite puzzled because they'd never come across this before. It just didn't fit into the pattern of victim soul that they knew. And they realized that this was a revelation that hadn't happened before. So there was all kinds of questions and difficulties about it. And Jesus said that with her death, that would all lift. So your death will tear the veils that cover the truths, and they will rise again like many suns, such as to dispel all the doubts and difficulties which they seem to be covered with in life. So, as long as you live in this low world, you will see little or nothing in others. And there's the headline for us as well, that we must not look for obvious results while we are alive. They will be afterwards. You will see little or nothing in others of all the great good which my will wants to do through you. But after your death, it will have its full effect. And you see that the divine will is flowing like a river around the world now. Louisa said, after this, I spent the night without being able to close my eyes either to sleep or to receive the usual visits of my beloved Jesus. Since when he comes, I doze off within him, and for me, this is more than sleep. Now, for her, dozing off is actually going into ecstasy for the rest of us. However, I spent that night doing the hours of the Passion and doing the usual rounds in his adorable will. When I saw it was daylight, this happens to me often, she said, I said to myself, my love, neither did you come, nor did you let me sleep. So how shall I go on today without you? At that moment, Jesus moved in my interior, telling me, now watch this, my daughter, in my will, there are no nights and no sleep. Now, that does not mean you can't go to bed and have a night's sleep. What he's trying to tell her is about the eternal day. That when you enter into the divine will, you're actually entering into the eternal day. And I want to give you Psalm 121, verse 4. The Lord who watches over his people neither slumbers nor sleeps. And we know from Maria Valtorta in her wonderful revelation about the ministry of Jesus, that Jesus actually slept very little. He spent his nights in prayer. When you go to the end of the book of Revelation and you find the New Jerusalem and you find that it doesn't have sunlight or daylight, it's lit by the glory of God and it is perennial day. Now, perennial day is that everybody is living this divine life on the earth. So that's what he means by it's always full daylight and full vigil. There's no time to sleep because there's so much to do. Now, there's the old idea that some of us got when we were children about heaven would be a very boring place because you're just sitting on a cloud playing a harp. There's no time to sleep because there's so much to do. There's so much to take and there's so much to be happy with in the divine will. Therefore, you must learn to live in the long day of my will so that my will may have its life and continuous attitude or working within you. So that the divine will is working in an unbroken way as it is in heaven. However, you will find the most beautiful rest, Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Because my will make you rise more and more into your God. Now, he is actually describing heaven. Because at whatever level you enter heaven, you grow more and more and more, we would say, with time. That's the only way we're able to express it. And so as you grow more and more and more, you become more and more and more and more like him. So that when the saints actually show themselves to us, they're actually quite different to what they were on earth. Because every second, again using our language, that they are in the glory of heaven, they're being transformed more and more and more like God. So you enter more and more into your God and he will enable you to understand him more. And that's what is a major part of the great joy and happiness of heaven, is that you understand him more and more. And the more you understand and the more your soul will be expanded to receive more of that eternal rest. So I want to give you a couple of scriptures for rest. Psalm 62 verse 5, Psalm 95 verse 11, Psalm 116 verse 7, Psalm 132 verse 14. So your soul will be expanded in order to receive that eternal rest with all the happiness and joy which the divine rest contains. Oh, what a beautiful rest this will be for you, a rest which can be found only in the divine will. Now, while he was saying this, Louisa said, he came out from within my interior, and throwing his arms around my neck, he clasped me tightly to himself, and I stretched out my arms and clasped him tightly to myself. And in the meantime, my sweet Jesus was calling many people who were clinging to his feet. Now he's giving her a taste of the generations in the divine will that are coming. At the time that he is talking to her, he's saying that these souls are clinging to his feet and he will raise them right up to live in his divine will. So then he disappeared. So let's come to July the 9th, 1925. You're now going to hear something more about suffering together with Jesus. Now, people in the world suffer on their own, which is very sad. It's kind of useless and it can be utterly depressing for them and all the rest of it. But someone in union with Jesus and someone living in the divine will suffering with Jesus can have absolutely extraordinary effects on the earth. Watch it. Watch what Jesus is going to say. So Louisa begins by saying, I felt I could no longer be without my sweet Jesus. For several days, I had to long for his return, but in vain. I would say to him from my heart, my love, come back to your little daughter. Don't you see that I can take no more? Ah, to what a hard martyrdom you expose my poor existence by depriving me of yourself. And tired and exhausted, I would abandon myself to his divine will. There's the solution. You're in a situation, you can't solve it, and the solution is abandon yourself to the divine will. So, while I was in this state of abandonment to the divine will, I was reading and I felt somebody extending his arms around my neck. My mind became drowsy and I found myself clasped in the arms of Jesus, all overshadowed and hidden in him. So we've been introduced to the meaning of that. The overshadowing is terribly important because you're told at the incarnation that the Holy Spirit overshadowed, that is completely covered, our Blessed Mother. So here she's completely overshadowed by Jesus. I wanted to tell him of my sorrow, but he gave me no time. He's been blocking her for the whole of volume 17 from telling her her troubles. He's trying to get her to put them aside and only think of him. Then he spoke to me and he said, my daughter, don't you want to convince yourself? When my justice, for a just reason, wants to chastise people, I'm forced to hide from you. Now, he's been telling her that since volume one. And she doesn't want to take it in. That's why he says, don't you want to convince yourself? In fact, you are nothing other than a little particle. That's very interesting. Which binds all other particles of the other creatures. Now, instead of particle, I would use the term sellotape or something sticky that connects everything else. And being in a familiar relationship with you, as though in feast, and wanting to strike the other particles around you, my justice finds itself in a difficult situation and feels dissuaded from striking the other ones. So during the past few days, he said, I had to do some chastisement, you know. It's like us saying, well, I was busy, I'm sorry, I couldn't answer the phone. He said, I just had to do a few chastisements. And the very way he says that tells you you're dealing with the Lord of the world. So I couldn't come to you. So let's come to the next paragraph. As he was saying this, Louisa said, I found myself outside of myself, and he showed me how in various points of the earth there had been earthquakes. So I want to give you Amos 3:7 for that. The Lord doesn't do anything without telling the prophets first. And at some places there were grave fires with the deaths of people, and in other places and other troubles and so on. And it seemed that the more grave evils would actually follow. Now, Louisa is seeing things in the future. Some of the stuff that Jesus showed to her actually happened in her own lifetime. Some of it was for the future. I was frightened, she said, and I prayed. Of course, that was the whole idea. And then my beloved Jesus came back, and before him, I saw myself totally ugly, as though withered. And I said to him, my life and my all, look at me, how ugly I have become. Psalm 22, verses 6 to 8. How I'm about to wither. Ah, how I change without you. Your privation makes me lose the freshness, the beauty that you've given to me. I feel I'm under a scorching sun that's draining all of the vital humours and makes me wither and be consumed. And then Jesus made me suffer a little bit together with him. Now, watch this. She's feeling withered and falling apart and dying. And as a solution to that, Jesus gives her a little bit of suffering. And she said, that suffering turned into a celestial dew over my soul, which restored the vital humours in me. And then taking my poor soul in his hands, he added, poor daughter of mine, don't fear. If my privation made you wither, my return will give you back all the freshness and the beauty and the colour and everything else. And your suffering together with me will not only be like dew, now watch this carefully, which rejuvenates you, but will serve as a continuous knocking with which I can knock at the doors of your soul, Revelation 3:20. And you can knock at mine, so that the doors may always be open. John 10, verses 7 and 9. Jesus is the gate or the door. And you can enter freely into me. So notice the tiny little bit of suffering. He says, it makes all the difference. It's like the salt on your food. And we have to be salted. He tells us that in the Sermon on the Mount. But he's knocking at the door of the human race now, and he wants us to open it with the fiat proclaimed in public. And so all the little things that we have to suffer or go through between now and the 15th of August, please, they're pure gold. Extremely important. Okay. You can enter freely into me and I into you, he said. And my breath will serve you as a breeze to preserve you in the beautiful freshness with which I created you. And as he was saying this, he blew very strongly over me. That's really wonderful. That's what he did in John 20. Now, I think it's verse 23 when he breathed over the apostles after the resurrection to bring them to life spiritually. So let's come to July the 20th, 1925, and Jesus puts Louisa into a state of immobility, which is actually quite frightening. But we know what's going on because he gives her an experience that explains something he wants to say to us about himself. As I was in my usual state, going through most bitter privations of my sweet Jesus, finally he made himself seen. And without saying even a word, he put me in a painful position of complete immobility. I felt the life, but I had no motion. I felt the breath, but I couldn't breathe. My whole person, I couldn't have even the slightest motion. That is extremely painful. And while feeling pain, I was unable to writhe because of the pain that I felt. But I was forced by the presence of Jesus and by his most holy will to remain completely immobile. Then my blessed Jesus, pleased to do so, he extended his arms as though to grab me and clasp me to his bosom. And he said, my daughter, have you seen how painful is the state of immobility? It is the hardest state because motion is life and we need to move. Because even while feeling bitter pains, motion is relief because it's a sign of life. Contortions are mute voices which ask for help and stir those around to have compassion. You've experienced how painful that is. But do you know why I put you in that state of immobility? This is, he gives her the experience and then he explains it. He said, I want to make you understand the state in which my grace finds itself, and I need reparation from you. Now, if you go back to volume 2, you'll have Jesus saying, I am grace, because grace is an outpouring of God's love upon us. So if he's saying that his grace is immobile in society, then you can see that people are spiritually dead. And he's asking her to make reparation. Oh, in what a state of immobility does my grace find itself? Grace is life, and it is continuous motion because it's an outflow from God to us. It is the continuous act of giving itself to creatures. This is God continuously giving himself life, love, peace, joy, forgiveness, everything. But creatures reject it and render it immobile. Grace feels the life and it wants to give life, but it's forced by human ingratitude to remain immobile and without motion. What pain, he said. My grace is light. See, grace is light. Grace is love. God is light. God is love. Grace is God. My grace is light, and as light, it naturally spreads. But the creatures do nothing but release darkness. That's John 3:19-21. And while my light wants to enter into them, the darkness which they spread paralyzes my light and renders it as though immobile and without life for the creatures. My grace is love and contains the power of being able to ignite everyone. But the creature, the human creature, loving something else, renders this love as though dead for itself, and my grace feels the most harrowing pain of the state of immobility that creatures put into it. Ephesians 4:30, grieving the Holy Spirit. Now, Jesus has given Louisa a graphic illustration of something we're not able to feel, and that is that the human will is able to block not only the divine will taking over, but is able to block the divine entrance completely. It's able to keep God out completely. And if society keeps God out completely, either we make reparation for that to open those doors again, and that you can see, understand, therefore, why we've been talking about opening doors, or there will be terrible chastisements because the Lord doesn't want society to land in hell. So he will have to do the operation without the anaesthetic. So he's now going to tell us in the next paragraph, what are the blocks? He's not going to leave us in any doubt about what they are. So he said, in what most painful constraints does my grace find itself? And this, not only from those who openly are said to be evil, but also from those who are said to be religious and to be pious souls. There's the scandal. Now, we've had this scandal going on for years and years and years, coming from people who are supposed to be completely committed to God. And many times because of trifles, because of something that's not to their liking, a mere whim, a most vile attachment, and because they do not find the satisfaction of their own wills, even in the very holy things, that's the thing I illustrated earlier, that if they get no satisfaction out of prayer, they won't pray. They won't go to Mass if they don't like the singing. The choir isn't to their liking. They prefer this kind of choir or that kind of choir or the other kind of choir. And to me, it's a very sad thing that the church has responded to that. So we end up thinking that Mass is something where you will be entertained, instead of a place where you put yourself completely on the altar and offer yourself with Jesus on that sacrificial altar to be consecrated and transformed into him and to become bread to feed the hungry. We're supposed to be transformed. And so just because they don't get their satisfaction of their own wills, even in very holy things, that's why I illustrated the Mass. While my grace is all motion and life for them, they render it immobile. And they cling, notice the cling, to what they like They cling to their whim, they cling to human attachments, and they cling to everything in which they feel the satisfaction of their own self. So, the Lord has put it blatantly clear. It's either self or God. It's either human will or divine will. And when it's put to you like that, there isn't a choice. So, in the place of my grace, they put their own self as life, in other words, the operating principle within us, and as their own idol. Now, this is the problem that has turned up in a huge way in the 20th century and has gone to its limits. I hope it's its limits anyway, in the 21st century. It's called autolatry. Idolatry is to make an idol of something else. Autolatry is to make an idol of yourself. People worship their own bodies. It has to be a particular size, a particular shape. It has to be a particular colour. It has to be a particular everything. It's incredible. And to me, the image of this autolatry is the selfie. I will glorify me even if nobody else does. And then, of course, then they're told to assert themselves, sell themselves and all the rest of it. Ugh. So he has made it perfectly clear here that what the issue is the self or God, the human will or the divine will. And we've got to, all those attachments have got to go. Sometimes you don't even know you're attached to something until somebody wants it. Make sure if somebody asks you for something you really like, that you're willing to let it go. In other words, that you've handed the ownership of everything you are and everything you have to the Lord. It is actually his. Let's come to the opposite of that now. But do you know who is the comforter and indivisible companion, the enrapturer who raptures the motion and the life of my grace, and even more, she accelerates its motion more and more and does not render it immobile, nor even for one instant? It's the one who lives in the divine will. The exact opposite. Where my will reigns, my grace is always in motion. It is always in feast. It always has something to do. It's never left grieving, Ephesians 4:30. Never left grieving or idle. The soul in whom my will reigns is the favourite of my grace, naturally allowing God to be God. She is its little secretary, in whom it deposits the secrets of its sorrows and its joys. The divine will entrusts everything to her because my will has sufficient space to receive the deposit which my grace contains, because she's nothing other than a continuous birth from the divine will. So if any of us are still hesitating about going public with that fiat to the Lord, which is so essential in 2020, Jesus said, you will be a continuous birth from my will. In other words, I'm born every single second. I don't worry about being born for a second. I don't know about you. So it's very good that in August the 2nd, 1925, Louisa bursts out with her, I love you for everything. It's really lovely. So this is more a prayer than anything else. I was praying, infusing myself in the holy divine volition. I wanted to go around everywhere, up to the empyreum, that is to God's own dwelling, in order to find that supreme I love you, which is not subject to any interruption. I wanted to make it my own so that I too might have an I love you never interrupted. You see, if it's a divine I love you, it's not interrupted, okay? Which might echo the eternal I love you, and by possessing within itself the source of the true I love you, I might have an I love you for all, for each one, for each motion, for each act, for each breath, for each heartbeat, and for each I love you of my Jesus himself. So in this prayer, Louisa is actually illustrating what Jesus has just been saying about the person living in the divine will, actually giving grace an opportunity to do all kinds of things. As I seemed to reach the bosom of the Eternal One, Louisa said, making their I love you my own, so that it's an eternal one, I kept repeating everywhere and upon each thing a sing-song of I love yous for my Supreme Lord. Very childlike and beautiful. Now, while I was doing this, my thought interrupted my I love you, telling me, what are you doing? You could be doing something else. And you see the rational mind moving in here. What's this, I love you? How special is all that? And my sweet Jesus, as though moving hurriedly in my interior, told me, what? How special is all the I love you for me? My daughter, the I love you is everything. The I love you is love, veneration, esteem, heroism. It's sacrifice. It's trust towards the one to whom it's directed. The I love you is to possess the one who encloses the I love you. The I love you is a small word, but it weighs as much as the whole eternity. The I love you encloses everything, envelops everyone. It diffuses, it restricts itself, and it rises up high. It descends down below. It impresses itself absolutely everywhere, but it never stops. How can you say this, my daughter? How special is all this? I love you. Its origin is eternal. In the I love you, number one, the celestial Father generated me. And in the I love you, number two, the Holy Spirit proceeded. Number three, in the I love you, the eternal fiat issued the whole of creation. Number four, and in the I love you, it forgave guilty man and redeemed him. So in the I love you, the soul finds everything in God and God finds everything in the soul. Therefore, the value of the I love you is infinite. It's full of life and of energy. It never tires. It surpasses everything and it triumphs over everything. And so this I love you for me, I want to see on your lips, in your heart, in the flight of your thoughts, in the drops of your blood, in the pains, in the joys, in the food you take, in everything. The life of my I love you must be very, very long in you, and my fiat reigning in you will place on it the seal of the divine I love you. Well, there's Jesus' answer. Don't think it requires a comment. So after this, Louisa said, a sun made itself present to my mind at an extremely high point. Now, the sun is the light. At 1 Timothy 6:16, God dwells in unapproachable light. Its light was inaccessible. From the center of it came out continuous little flames, each one containing an I love you. And as they were coming out, they placed themselves as though in order around this inaccessible light. However, these little flames remained as though bound to a thread of light, to that inaccessible light which nourished the life of the little flames. These little flames were so many as to fill heaven and earth. I seem to see our God as the beginning and the origin of everything. And the little flames, the whole of creation, I saw as a divine birth and of pure love. I too was a little flame. And my sweet Jesus pushed me to take flight through each other little flame in order to place on them the double I love you, his and mine. I don't know how I found myself outside of myself to go around in the midst of those little flames and impress my I love you on each one of them. But there were so many I would get lost. However, a supreme force, which is the divine will, made me resume in order the order and the round of my I love you. Then afterwards, she said, I found myself inside a vast garden, and to my surprise, I found my Queen Mother, who, drawing me near, told me, my daughter, come with me to work in this garden. Now that sounds awfully like the Song of Songs, chapter 6, verses 10 to 11, where the bride is invited to go and work in the Lord's vineyard. We must plant in it celestial and divine flowers and fruits, Galatians 5:22. It's now almost empty, and if there's any plant at all, it is terrestrial and human. In other words, we've not yet moved into the era of the divine will. Therefore, we have to root them out, so that this garden may be fully pleasing to my son Jesus. The seeds which we must plant are all of my virtues, and my works and my pains, which contain the seed of the fiat voluntas tua, because our Blessed Mother had the divine will in her soul from the first moment of her life. There was nothing I did which did not contain this seed of the will of God. I would have contented myself with doing nothing rather than operating or suffering without the seed. All my glory, the dignity of mother, the height or the glory of being queen, The supremacy over all came to me from that seed of the divine will. The whole of creation, all beings recognized me as dominating over them because they saw in me reigning the supreme will. So the big difference is that the divine will was in everything in her. Therefore, we, that's our Blessed Mother and Louisa, will unite everything I did together with everything you have done with this seed of the supreme volition, and we'll plant this little garden. In other words, preparing the future full of hope for the rest of us to go into the same garden and to put our little seeds in. So we fused the seeds, beautiful, which my celestial mother had, which were many, and together with the few of mine, and I don't know how I found, she said, and we began to form little holes and to plant the seeds. But while we were doing this from behind the walls of the garden, which were extremely high, we heard noises of weapons and cannons and that they were fighting in a horrible way. We were forced to run in order to give help. Notice that this preparation for the divine will is going on while there's world wars going on and all the rest of it, and also while there's huge opposition to the church. The walls are extremely high. Now, when you come to the New Jerusalem at the end of the book of Revelation, you'll be told that the walls are extremely high. In other words, there are certain people who cannot come in because they're not in the right relationship. So she said, we were forced to run and give them help. And as we arrived, we saw peoples of various races, of different colours and many nations united together, and they were battling and striking. There was terror and fright. But while I was seeing this, I found myself inside of myself, but with such fright, she said, that also with the sorrow of having said not even a word to my celestial mother about my hard state. Now notice that she's been blocked from talking about herself. And she has this urge in her all the time. I want to tell them how difficult everything is. So may the holy will of God be always blessed, and may everything be for his glory. Now, I think that image there of Louisa working with our Blessed Mother to sow the seeds for the new era of the kingdom of the divine will is absolutely beautiful. And notice they do it regardless of what's going on in society. And that's what the Lord wants us to do as well. Take your eyes off what the world is doing and what the world is saying and all the rest of it, and get on with sowing the seeds of the acts in the divine will to prepare the future for them all. So we now come to the last text in volume 17, and it's August the 4th, 1925. So one who lives in the divine will is in communication with all of creation. So Louisa said, after going through various days of total privation of my sweet Jesus, I kept repeating my sorrowful refrain, everything is over for me, I'll never see him again. I will never hear his voice again, so much delighted me. I have been abandoned by the one who formed all of my contentment and was everything to me. What a prolonged martyrdom, what life without Jesus, without Jesus. But while my heart was drowned with pains, my sweet Jesus came out from within my interior, because he's there all the time. And as he took me in his arms, I threw my arms around his neck, abandoning my head upon his breast, because I could take no more. And Jesus, squeezing me tightly to himself, leaned his knees on my breast. Now, you're not meant to take this physically, right? Pressing on it very strongly, and said to me, my daughter, you must die continuously. What he's saying to her, in all of the privation and the suffering and everything else, we have got to die continuously to ourselves. We want a life of just peace and joy and happiness, but that is for heaven. You do have peace and joy and happiness in the depths of your being, living in the divine will, but you're still living on the earth. There's still awful things happening on the earth. There's still more work that the Lord wants to do in us. And so we have to die daily. But St. Paul told us that. Just go to the letters of St. Paul. He said very clearly, you've got to die daily. In other words, the human will has this awful propensity to move back and push back and push back, and we've got to keep pushing it back. So the surrendering to the Lord is every moment of every day for the rest of our days. You must die continuously, he said. And as he was saying this, he shared various pains with me. And then, assuming a more affable look, he said, my daughter, what do you fear if in you there is the power of my will. Now, we're at the end of volume 17. We're about to go to the volume that's halfway through. And I find it fascinating that with all the experience that Louisa has, she still hasn't grasped. I mean, in a practical sense, she hasn't grasped the sheer power of the divine will working in her. And I think that this is being said to illustrate our problem, that we can't believe it's at the... We accept it and it's written there and we say yes to it and we want it and all the rest of it. But in our everyday actions, we find it difficult to actually take on board the fact that there's a divine will operating in us. And it's true, he said, that this will of mine is in you, that in one instant I transformed you into my pains and you with love offered yourself to receive them. And as you were suffering, you stretched out your arms to embrace my will. And while you were embracing the divine will, everything that lives in my will, that's the angels, the saints, my celestial mother and the very divinity, felt the tightness of your embrace. Really underline that. If you're in the divine will, all of the heavenly dwellers experience what you're doing. They felt the tightness of your embrace and they all ran towards you to embrace you in return. And in chorus they said, how pleasing and dear is the embrace of our little exiled one who lives on earth to do the will of God alone, just as we do it in heaven. So he's saying to her that while you're experiencing the suffering side of the divine will, those who are experiencing the joy side of the divine will are looking in fascination at an ordinary person who was born with original sin like everybody else, is now living as they're living. And they're looking in total amazement at this. She's our joy. She is the new and only feast that comes to us from the earth. And Jesus said to her, if you only knew what it means to live in my will, there's no division between the soul and heaven. You see, we know the words, but it's so hard to take it on board. Wherever my will is, she is also. Her acts, her pains, her words are in act and operating in any place where the divine will is present. And since the divine will is everywhere, the soul places herself in the order of creation. And through the power of the supreme volition, she's in communication with all created things. And just as created things are in order and harmony among themselves, each one is the support of the other. And not one of them can move from their place. And may this never be, if just one thing created by me should move, the creation would be all upset. There's an extraordinary balance in the planets, in the stars. The astrophysicists are still absolutely fascinated that they just seem to be hanging there in space. I mean, what's hold? Just think of the weight of planet Earth, and it's one of the smaller planets in the solar system. Some planets are twice the size of it. What's holding it up? They're beginning to grasp that there's an extraordinary balance in the whole of creation. And Jesus is saying that when the divine will comes to reign in us, that we could actually upset that balance. So if any of them could move from their place, he said, the whole of creation would be upset. There is a secret among them. The astrophysicists want the next sentence terribly. There is a secret among them, a mysterious force, such that while they live suspended in the air without any support, by the force of communication which they have among themselves, each one sustains the other. And that's how he wants us as a community of beings on the earth to operate as well, that we all look after each other and therefore everybody thrives. But when everybody's in their own little place, only looking after themselves, nobody thrives. I think that's fantastic. by a mysterious force that while they live suspended in the air without any support, by the force of communication which they have among themselves, each one sustains the other. In the same way, one who does my will is in communication with everybody else and is sustained by all the works of her Creator. Therefore, all recognize her, all love her, and all offer her the electricity or the power and the secret of living together with them, suspended between heaven and earth, all sustained by the wonderful supreme force of the divine will. I love that paragraph. I think it's fantastic because I love anything to do with the stars and the creation. And I love listening to what the scientists are saying. So I'm going to stop there because we have finished volume 7.